confused about fact. That's deeply troubling, and the American people deserve better.
That was Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump last night in the ABC News presidential debate. We're joined now by Carol Anderson, professor of African American Studies at Emory University, author of a number of books, including One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression's Destroying Our Democracy. Her other books, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America, and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Professor Anderson, if you can respond to what you've just listened to about President Trump not admitting still that he lost the 2020 election and what this means for this election.
That was a powerful moment, because underlying that was Trump's racism. It was when Newt Gingrich said they stole the election in Atlanta. They stole the election in Philadelphia. They stole the election in Milwaukee. They basically stole it in Detroit. So what they are identifying are cities where there are sizable Black populations as the site of this theft of American democracy. And that it is that telling of that theft over and over and over in all of those court cases and in the language that led to January 6th, that you see this kind of racialized determination of who is an American citizen, who has the right to vote, who is worthy of the right to vote, and who is worthy of being able to vote for me. That is what Donald Trump is saying. So basically what he is doing is eliminating millions of African Americans, millions of Latinos, millions of Asian Americans, and millions of indigenous people from the citizenship of voting rights, and basically saying, if you don't count them, then I won. And so that for him is the fraud, that you have folk of color actually voting in the United States of America. And then to try to say they're importing all of these immigrants. This is the new lie by the Republicans, that you have all of these non-citizens voting, except it's already a federal crime for non-citizens to vote in a federal election. So again, it's ginning up, stirring up racial hatred, stirring up that divide, stirring up the kind of sense that there is something untoward, something tainted about our elections, even though there have been a series of audits, a series of hand recounts. There have been a series of going through and having secretaries of state look at what is happening in their elections and basically saying, there's no fraud here. There's no fraud here. There's nothing that would determine the election in terms of fraud.
Let's go back to the ABC News presidential debate. This is debate moderator David Muir.
I want to move on now to race and politics in this country. Mr. President, you recently said of Vice President Harris, quote, I didn't know she was Black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn Black, and now she wants to be known as Black. I want to ask a bigger picture question here tonight. Why do you believe it's appropriate to weigh in on the racial identity of your opponent?
I don't, and I don't care. I don't care what she is. I don't care. You make a big deal out of something. I couldn't care less. Whatever she wants to be is okay with me.
But those were your words, so I'm asking.
I don't know. I mean, all I can say is I read where she was not Black, that she put out, and I'll say that. And then I read that she was Black, and that's okay. Either one was okay with me. That's up to her.
Vice President Harris, your thoughts on this?
I think it's a tragedy that we have someone who wants to be president who has consistently over the course of his career attempted to use race to divide the American people. You know, I do believe that the vast majority of us know that we have so much more in common than what separates us, and we don't want this kind of approach that is just constantly trying to divide us, and especially by race. And let's remember how Donald Trump started. He was he owned buildings, and he was investigated because he refused to rent property to Black families. Let's remember, this is the same individual who took out a full page ad in the New York Times calling for the execution of 5 young Black and Latino boys who were innocent, the Central Park 5. Took out a full-page ad calling for their execution. This is the same individual
who spread birther lies about the first black president of the United States. And I think the American people want better than that.
That was the exchange last night between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Professor Carol Anderson, your response to that exchange?
I thought it just was so emblematic of where they are in terms of the vision of America. So you heard Trump going, well, I don't care what she is. But, you know, she did say that, you know, she wasn't black, and now all of a sudden she's black. And so what that is doubling down on is that kind of sense that using race, using blackness as a means to get over, using black identity as a means to gain something that you're not worthy of having. So that is the subtext of what Donald Trump is doing right there. And then you have Kamala Harris coming back and giving us his really long history of racism. And so there's a moment in that debate where Trump's like, yes, she had to go back years and years and years. The reason she went back years and years was to show that this is who he is. From the denying of rental applications from African Americans to the Central Park Five, even though the Supreme Court had said that execution for the crime of rape is unconstitutional, particularly because it has been so racially driven in the United States, where there were years where only African Americans were executed for rape. Then to go to birtherism, which is where he basically, as I said, he threw a kilo of pure uncut white supremacy on the table and said to the people that he wanted to vote for him, snort. Barack Obama is not a legitimate American. So that is what that was. Birtherism was to deny the legitimacy of a black man as U.S. president. And then he did the Mexicans are rapists and criminals. Then he did Muslims are terrorists. Then he did during COVID, Kung Flu and the China virus. All of that was stoking the racism. And remember the anti-Asian violence that began to reap down on Asian American communities here in the United States, because he gave the permission structure for that kind of racial violence. And so she's laying it out. And that racial violence then carried through into January 6th. Remember, we had the Confederate flag being flown in the Capitol, something that even Robert E. Lee was not able to accomplish.
Now, I wanted to ask you also about this this dark vision of Trump's and the campaign about how the country is spiraling out of control because of crime, when, again, crime in the United States is at virtually at all-time lows for the last 30 years. And yet he continues to point a picture of an increase in crime rate. And what is he signaling to his supporters with that?
What he is signaling, again, is that crime is related to blackness. Crime is related to immigrants who are not white. Crime is the thing. It is that dystopian vision that white Americans need to be fearful of all of these folks of color, that they cannot walk outside their doors without being attacked, without being mugged, without being shot. That the cities, you know, so when he was talking about, you know, these cities have just burned down to the ground, except the people who live in those cities know that those cities have not burned down to the ground. Again, it is this way of defining cities, these urban areas, and urban areas become synonymous with folk of color, that these urban areas are unsafe. And so white Americans are not safe in America as long as we have all of these folks of color. And then he links that with immigrants coming in. And when he says immigrants, he means immigrants of color coming into the United States, again, linking that with crime. So, again, raising that sense of fear, 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 fear. And when he says, I'm the only one who can solve this, what he is basically saying is, I'm your white savior. And so that is what that dystopian vision is about. So although crime is going down, he's saying you can't trust the FBI statistics. You can't trust your eyes. You can't trust how you're living. You can't trust that you're in the park and enjoying yourself. You can't trust that you're bicycling and having no problems. You can't trust that you're going to the grocery store. No problem. You can't trust the way that you're living your life because I'm telling you that you are not safe. You are not safe. And that is the signal that he's sending, a racialized fear of crime. So think of like the Willie Horton ad of the old George H.W. Bush piece running against Dukakis. That was about the fear of black crime. And that is what Trump is playing on right there.
Carol Anderson, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of African-American studies at Emory University. Among her books, One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, as well, White Rage, the Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Coming up, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, former presidential candidate Ralph Nader on last night's debate, and then we'll talk about abortion. Stay with us.
Get higher. I've got the capitalist blues. When I give everything, I won't have much more to lose. I am swimming in an ocean of sharks. They are telling me how I'm gonna make.
Blues by Leila McCullough. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to look at Tuesday night's debate, let's turn to look at how the economy was discussed. This is Vice President Kamala Harris speaking at the ABC News presidential debate.
Donald Trump has no plan for you. And when you look at his economic plan, it's all about tax breaks for the richest people. I am offering what I describe as an opportunity economy, and the best economists in our country, if not the world, have reviewed our relative plans for the future of America. What Goldman Sachs has said is that Donald Trump's plan would make the economy worse. Mine would strengthen the economy. What the Wharton School has said is Donald Trump's plan would actually explode the deficit. 16 Nobel laureates have described his economic plan as something that would increase inflation and by the middle of next year would invite a recession.
We are going to take in billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars. I had no inflation, virtually no inflation. They had the highest inflation perhaps in the history of our country because I've never seen a worse period of time. People can't go out and buy cereal or bacon or eggs or anything else. The people of our country are absolutely dying with what they've done. They've destroyed the economy. And all you have to do is look at a poll. The polls say 80 and 85 and even 90% that the Trump economy was great, that their economy was terrible.
We're joined now by Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Columbia University professor, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. Professor Stiglitz is also currently the chief economist at the Roosevelt Institute, one of the 16 Nobel economists who warned about Trump's policies. And we're joined by Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, and former presidential candidate. His newest book, Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country That Works for the People. Professor Stiglitz, your response to what we just watched?
Well, the fact is that he hasn't a plan for the economy. He has made proposals that will lead to more inflation and slower growth. And it's not only what's going to happen in the short run. In the long run, he's going to undermine the overall growth, the strategic advantage of the United States. Let me just give you two examples. He has proposed enormous tariffs. Now, tariffs are just a tax. And the tariffs are on the goods that people buy every day. And those enormous tariffs will increase inflation. He has opposed the IRA. It's called the Inflation Reduction Act because there's one important provision in there that brings drug prices down. That provision says that the government can bargain with drug companies to bring prices down. He's going to repeal that. And so drug prices are going to go up. On the other hand, in the long run, what's important? Well, the reason we have a stronger economy than other countries is because of our technological innovation, our universities, science. What has he proposed? When he was president, we know the record. Drastic cuts in science budgets. One of the reasons the economists agree that the American economy does well is because of the rule of law. He has done everything he can to undermine the rule of law, including he's threatened the independence of the central bank. So if you look together at all of his proposals, they are a set of proposals that will do very good, very well for the very rich, because he's going to cut the taxes on the billionaires and the rich corporations. But for the overall economy, there's going to be higher prices, higher inflation, slower growth, more unemployment. Quite to use a word that he uses, it would be a disaster.
Professor Stiglitz, on the issue of tariffs, however, isn't the Biden administration in somewhat a weaker position on this, given the fact that they continued the tariffs that Trump had imposed on China, as he mentioned in the debate, and that Biden is proposing, for instance, for electric vehicles and other forms of goods from China, even higher tariffs?
Well, you know, one of the critical distinctions between Harris and Trump is moderation and balance. And there are many situations where you have multiple goals and you sort of have to balance them very carefully. One of our goals is that we have to become less dependent on China. You know, in the pandemic, we couldn't even produce the face masks that we needed. We had to get them from China. We get transistors from Taiwan, and we have to become more independent on that as well. But we get an awful lot of things from China, and we have to become more independent, more resilient. And that's where the tariffs on China are sending an important signal to our firms: set up more robust supply chains. So that's what they're trying to do. What does Trump want to do? He wants to increase these tariffs 50-60%, and that would be a rupture. And who would pay the price of that rupture? It would be American consumers, American workers. We get a lot of parts that we depend on. Manufacturing would be hurt as a result. Our entire economy would be put into great stress.
Ralph Nader, I want to bring you into this conversation. You wrote the book, Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country that Works for the People. You've talked about the two parties as a duopoly. Do you feel that this debate covered the issues, the economic issues that would help the most people?
No, actually, it was a lost opportunity for Kamala Harris. It's easy to look good against Trump. He lies, he rants, he repeats 8 times on the immigration lies, for example, that Juan pointed out. But she basically said she wanted to be the president of all the people. All right, well, there's not much difference what she said and didn't say with Biden. She repeated again, Israel has a right to defend itself. It's slaughtering already over 300,000 Palestinians, bombing in Lebanon, doing whatever it wants with U.S. weapons. And she can't get herself to say Palestinians have a right to defend themselves. They're the ones who are occupied and oppressed for all these decades. So there's very little difference. She comforted the oil and gas industry, saying oil and gas production is at a record high. She was pretty weak on climate violence in terms of any detail. She didn't go for full Medicare. just like Biden, he doesn't like full Medicare. She reassured the military-industrial complex by saying she was going to have the best fighting force in the world. She didn't really get specific on taxing the undertaxed giant corporations, who are, you know, many of them are making billions of profits in the U.S. and paying no taxes or very few taxes. She didn't even go after Trump for his major violations of federal law and the Constitution itself. That's the main rap on Trump. He's a serial law violator. And so, and the most amazing thing, Amy, is she didn't even make minimum wage front and center. The Democrats aren't talking about minimum wage in any authentic ways. There are 25 million people in this country who make less than $15 an hour. So it's the taboos that I'm focusing on, which is why I wrote the book and why we have the CapitolHillCitizen.com, which people can get a print copy of, first-class mail, is because if we allow all these taboos, no talk about hundreds of billions of dollars of corporate welfare, government-guaranteed capitalism, bailouts, subsidies, giveaways, no talk about the corporate crime wave that the mainstream press reports on in terms of corporate abuses, but there's no cracking down on corporate crooks, and she fancies herself a former prosecutor. No talk about empowering workers and unions by Kamala Harris. No talk about ending big money influence in politics, of course. And the repetition of the debate, they all repeated. He did this. He's a ditto man on the debates. He's just talking to his base.
Well, Ralph, we're going to have a
lot of opportunities to widen the debates. If you don't widen the debates, widen the framework of public dialogue, you cannot pay attention to the damage that's being done to our democratic society
and the role of workers
and consumers.
We're going to continue this debate. It will clearly be one between you and Professor Stiglitz after the show and post online at democracynow.org. But we have to move on right now to another key issue that was raised in the debate last night, what may be the only debate, and that is abortion. We look now at the issue of abortion. This is Donald Trump speaking on the ABC News presidential debate.
The plan is, as you know, the vote is, they have abortion in the ninth month. They even have, and you can look at the governor of West Virginia, the previous governor of West Virginia, not the current governor, is doing an excellent job, but the governor before, he said, the baby will be born and we will decide what to do with the baby. In other words, we'll execute the baby. And that's why I did that, because that predominates, because they're radical. The Democrats are radical in that. And her vice presidential pick, which I think is a horrible pick, by the way, for our country, because he is really out of it. But her vice presidential pick says abortion in the ninth month is absolutely fine. He also says execution after birth, it's an execution, no longer abortion, because the baby is born, is okay. And that's not okay with me, hence the vote.
There is no state in this country where it is legal to kill a baby after it's born. Madam Vice President, I want to get your response to President Trump.
Well, as I said, you're going to hear a bunch of lies, and that's not actually a surprising fact. Let's understand how we got here. Donald Trump hand-selected three members of the United States Supreme Court with the intention that they would undo the protections of Roe v. Wade. And they did exactly as he intended. And now in over 20 states, there are Trump abortion bans, which make it criminal for a doctor or nurse to provide health care. In one state, it provides prison for life. Trump abortion bans that make no exception even for rape and incest, which understand what that means. A survivor of a crime, a violation to their body, does not have the right to make a decision about what happens to their body next. That is immoral. And one does not have to abandon their faith or deeply held beliefs to agree. The government, and Donald Trump certainly, should not be telling a woman what to do with her body. I have talked with women around our country. You want to talk about this is what people wanted? Pregnant women who want to carry a pregnancy to term, suffering from a miscarriage, being denied care in an emergency room because the healthcare providers are afraid they might go to jail, and she's bleeding out in a car in the parking lot? She didn't want that. Her husband didn't want that. A 12 or 13-year-old survivor of incest being forced to carry a pregnancy to term? They don't want that. And I pledge to you, when Congress passes a bill to put back in place the protections of Roe v. Wade, as President of the United States, I will proudly sign it into law. But understand, if Donald Trump were to be reelected, he will sign a national abortion ban. Understand, in his Project 2025, there would be a national abortion, a monitor that would be monitoring your pregnancies, your miscarriages.
That's Kamala Harris and President Trump debating the issue of abortion in last night's ABC debate that was moderated by Lindsay Davis and David Muir. In these last few minutes we have together, Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent at The Nation magazine in Boston. If you can respond to President Trump's shifting approach to abortion and what Kamala Harris argued.
I mean, Amy, can we just pause for a minute and talk about how sick it is that we're now almost a year into Israel's war on Gaza, and the only, and, you know, images emerging every day of mothers and fathers in you know, Gaza weeping over the bodies of their dead infants and children. And the only dead baby we heard mentioned from the debate stage was a figment of Donald Trump's imagination. I mean, this talking point, which is his number one talking point on abortion, that abortions happen after birth. And we finally had a moderator who was prepared. I mean, please, let's give Lindsay Davis the Pulitzer Prize for best one-liner in a presidential debate, because she nailed that, right? In no state in the country is it legal to kill an infant after birth, okay? But I thought Kamala Harris was finally out there channeling the outrage and the profound sense of violation that many people across this country feel in the wake of the Dobbs decision. I wish she had pushed back more strongly on the issue of later abortions. You know, the issue of abortions taking place after the viability point, which, of course, you know, Roe v. Wade, that framework, which Harris said she supported, ends the protections and allowing states to ban abortion after that point. I wish Harris had been more staunch in defending people who need abortions later in pregnancy. But of course, you see Donald Trump, you know, across the board trying to espouse basically every conceivable position on the issue. And Harris, I think, finally, we have a candidate who, you know, eyes shining, talking about women bleeding out in parking lots, you know, having their IVF treatments interrupted, was really channeling the rage and sadness that so many people feel after Dobbs.
And Amy, this whole thing of Trump claiming that that he did by the elimination of Roe v. Wade, he allowed the states to decide something that the people kept telling him that they wanted, for the state governments to decide how to control women's bodies.
I mean, you know, again, you have this situation where Donald Trump is claiming credit for overturning Roe v. Wade, but then saying he's going to make IVF free, and then saying maybe he's going to vote in favor of the abortion rights ballot initiative in Florida, but then maybe he's not, but then maybe he will again. I mean, Trump is a moving target. But look, we have to look at his record here. What did this man do? He overturned 50 years of precedent, right? He put the Supreme Court justices on the court to overturn Roe v. Wade. People are not going to forget that. I mean, to quote the great Taylor Swift, who, of course, endorsed Kamala Harris and Tim Walz on Tuesday. In plain sight, you hid, but you are what you did. Okay? I don't think we're going to forget what Donald Trump did when it comes to abortion rights.
Well, Amy Littlefield, we want to thank you very much for being with us. And when Taylor Swift issued that endorsement last night, she signed it Childless Cat Lady, with a photo of her cradling one of her cats. Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent at The Nation. I want to thank all the folks who joined us today, including Ralph Nader and Joe Stiglitz. And you can see our continued debate that they will have after the show at democracynow.org, and Carol Anderson, as well as Jean Guerrero. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Dokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresaina, Tammy Warren, Efterina Nadura, Sam Alkov, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.